Good afternoon. The issues to be resolved in this case are several, and I believe, based upon the Colorado case law that I've looked at, that these are issues of first impression for this court. The primary issues to be resolved is whether a notice of a potential breach of contract is sufficient notice of an adverse claim under CRS Section 48303. Whether the right to purchase an asset is a claim under the Fraudulent Transfer Act, and whether the protected purchaser provisions should be the same under both the UCC and the Fraudulent Transfer Act. Also, is specific performance a remedy under the Fraudulent Transfer Act? And to this end, should the court have awarded damages rather than specific performance for the Fraudulent Transfer Act? With respect to the protected purchaser provisions under the UCC, public policy favors the new provisions. Under the new provisions, a buyer does not need to determine whether or not the seller is breaching a contract. The onus now is on the seller. Under the previous provisions, it was argued in several cases that the buyer needed to do due diligence, and if there was a potential breach of contract, the buyer would be taken out of the protected purchaser provisions. That is no longer the case. Again, Colorado has not ruled on this issue, and in fact, under these new UCC provisions, I was unable to find any cases in any jurisdiction ruling on this particular issue. But public policy seems to favor this. The seller, again, is the one that knows whether there's a breach of contract out there. The buyer may generally know about contracts or whatever, but the buyer is not in the position to know whether the seller is in breach, or for that fact, the third party is maybe asserting claims. Otherwise, if we put the onus on the buyer, it could end up being that the UCC ends up being just a specific performance remedy, which the court did in this case. The other aspect, as far as public policy goes, is that if a third party can come in after the fact, and in this case, almost 2 years after the fact, and come in and say, no, this security is mine, give it to me, it allows this potential third-party buyer to speculate on the security. There is absolutely no obligation to come forward early and lay the claim there, or require the seller to sell the security. They can sit back, watch the market, and in this case, in 2004, it was worth $50,000. Meadow Homes acknowledged in 2006 it was worth $50,000, and surprise, surprise, a year later, it's worth $500,000. And Meadow Homes is making the claim for the bond. So,
Counsel, let me ask you this if I can.
Okay.
Article 8 obviously applies to all kinds of investment securities. This is a bond, which I think both parties agree is covered by Article 8.
Yes.
The two parties, let's call it the Horvat entities, the Horvat Group, Box Elder, whoever, and Meadow Homes that created this bond, tied it to the ownership and development of the land. I mean, this is not simply like Exxon stock, is it? This is something that the two parties that helped create the bond said it's important that the ultimate developer own this bond. Is that true? Because the bond gave some water rights that were important for the developer to have as opposed to an unrelated third party. Would you agree with that or not?
Yes, I would agree that there were development rights among Meadow Homes and the Horvat entities. But Bowens was not a big player in this. I mean, he is the signatory to a couple of the agreements.
And including the agreement that created this bond.
Yes, exactly. But if you look at the entire series of the agreements, Bowens is not the big player. It's Meadow Homes and it's Horvat.
Well, taking Bowen out of the mix for a moment, I'm just, in terms of the bond itself, the ultimate right of ownership turned on who was going to have to develop the property. And it seems to make sense because this bond had water rights that were tied to the property. Isn't that right? Isn't this different than just a generic investment security?
It is different from that extent. But again, those were issues between Meadow and Horvat. not Meadow and Bowens. And so the question goes right back to, did Horvat breach the agreement? Well, is it Bowens' responsibility to determine whether or not Horvat breached the agreement with Meadow? As the court found that Bowens was under the understanding that these agreements had terminated in August of 2004. And so he was under the impression that there was no impediment whatsoever. Now, there may have been stuff going on between Horvat and Meadow and the seller, but there is nothing in the record to indicate whatsoever that Bowens had knowledge of this information.
What you just said is directly contrary to what the court found. The court found that Bowen had notice of a contract, right?
Notice of the settlement agreement and the underlying contract. But the underlying contract, by its terms, expired August 31st, 2004. And there were subsequent negotiations that went on between August 31st, 2004 and December of 2004, which ultimately ended with an amendment. The thing is that Bowens purchased the securities in October of 2004, after the underlying contract had expired, but before the amendments had been entered into.
Do you agree that notice is a question of fact? Whether Bowens had notice of an adverse claim is a question of fact. Understanding that you're saying a contract claim is not a property claim, that's a question of law, but the notice issue, that's a question of fact, is it not?
I would say normally that would be. However, in this case, I do believe that it's a question of law. And the reason being is that the dates that we are dealing with are on the agreements. This court can construe the agreements, including the agreements of the purchase of the bonds.
But I can't construe the record to say that Bowens have notice in October of 04. I can't decide that as a matter of law. That's a fact question.
Well, there were no findings made by the trial court that Bowens had any knowledge of any of the subsequent negotiations. The only thing that he had knowledge of was the underlying agreement and the settlement agreement. And the record is devoid of any findings that he had knowledge. And so now we look forward at the record. The record is the underlying contract expires August of 2004. He purchases October 2004. The subsequent agreements are December 2004. Is he charged with knowledge of agreements that happened after the purchase of his bond?
I guess it depends. We don't have the whole record.
The issue, an agreement that, it would seem to me that an agreement that occurs after the purchase, I don't know how a person could have notice of an agreement that happened in the future.
What if they tell him? I mean, they told him in October. I mean, he knew that, in fact, the project had not closed. And what he knew or didn't know in October, we can't tell because we don't have the record, do we?
Well, again, I believe that it goes with the trial court's findings. He understood that it terminated. And with respect to those issues, I think that the trial court was explicit on where that went. Horvat had knowledge. There was clearly knowledge on the part of Horvat. And the trial court made many findings about Horvat's knowledge. But the trial court made no findings with regard to Bowen's knowledge. And if the court feels that that is a question of fact that needs to be resolved, then that's probably an issue that needs to be handled on remand there. But I think that the trial court was pretty clear that there was not an issue of knowledge on the part of Bowen's part of these negotiations. Even if there was negotiations, though, it still doesn't change the fact that this is a potential breach of contract, which is not actionable. Now, with regard to the Fraudulent Conveyance Act, the issues there are, is a right to purchase a claim? And with respect to that issue, everything that I've seen, it's a debt of some type. It's not an obligation to purchase. It's an obligation like the standard classical fraudulent conveyance. There's a creditor, has a judgment. goes after, tries to collect on the judgment, and the debtor swirls away assets. They bring in assets sufficient to satisfy the debt, and no more. And with that, I notice that I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal for me.
Certainly.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Robin Nolan. I represent Meadow Homes Development Corporation. I have co-counsel here, Larry Martinez, as well as David Rye, the president of Meadow Homes here. I think a brief timeline would be important here to understand the notice provisions that were spoken about by Mr. Thorburn. The underlying contract at issue in this case, which was to govern the purchase of the land and the division of the land in two phases, occurred in 1999. In 2000 is when the pre-closing agreement occurred. And in the pre-closing agreement, the parties to that were Meadow Homes and BECR. And the important behind that is that the pre-closing agreement was created because the Meadow Homes provided financing to BECR, which is one of the plaintiffs in this action, to finance the closing on phase one. Phase one was also has Mr. Bowens as an owner. So he's been very central to this whole development of this land. The pre-closing agreement, one of the conditions that Meadow put on providing financing to BECR to close on phase one was that it would now be provided rights to close on future phases of the land. So the wording was that in the event of BECR's default on the underlying contract to close on future phases, then the seller was obligated to provide notice to Meadow Homes of BECR's default, and then Meadow Homes had 15 days to purchase the phase. And so that's important here because that extends to what was spoken about before about the notice. That's the notice. The notice did not provide that the underlying contract ever terminated on a specific date. The notice provided that the contract would terminate only if Meadow Homes, after being provided notice by the seller of BECR's default, then didn't close on the phase. So then we go to the next step, which is the 2002 inclusion agreement, which you spoke about, that created the bond. Mr. Bowens was a party to that inclusion agreement, and the purpose behind that was to provide water to the land. The next step was a settlement agreement, which came about in an effort to resolve certain issues that had arisen regarding the development of this land. And in the settlement agreement, both plaintiffs, as well as John J. Horvat and Mr. Bowens, as well as Meadow, were all signatories to the settlement agreement. And in the settlement agreement, then it provides the next stage of the notice provision at issue here. So it incorporates what happened in the pre-closing agreement for notice, that in the event of BECR's default, that Meadow Homes would be provided a 15-day notice period to then close on the phase. But then it added the element of the bond, and that if Meadow Homes was provided the notice, did purchase the phase, then it had the right to demand the bond and pay $50,000 for it from BECR. So that's the stage of what happened. Mr. Bowens was central to all of these agreements. Mr. Bowens, as found repeatedly by the trial court in the oral ruling, was a signatory to the settlement agreement. So he was aware of the notice provisions. What I think is being misunderstood here is that, or misstated, is what notice did Mr. Bowens have? Mr. Bowens did not have notice of a certain date of the underlying contract being terminated. It didn't terminate because, pursuant to the language I told you, it only terminates once Meadow Homes doesn't close on the phase. There's never a date specific. And any language as it closed on August 31st, 2004, it's nowhere in the documents, especially the documents that Mr. Bowens was the signatory to. So then what happened would be in 2006, that exact situation occurred where BECR failed to close on phase four, And so the seller provided notice to Meadow Homes that the purchase hadn't happened. Meadow Homes then closed within the 15 days on phase four, then it made a demand for the bond.
So there were 2 years of extensions between the original separate, I understand it's a separate agreement, but there was an agreement that said closing was supposed to be August 31 of 04. There were a bunch of negotiated extensions with BECR after that time?
As I understand it, right. Meadow Homes is not a party to these extensions, but it, when it provided was provided the notice from the seller that the closing hadn't happened was in 2006, correct? Well, what had happened then, unbeknownst to Meadow, when it made the demand for the bond, was that actually the bond had been transferred down the line. So if you figure 2003 was when the settlement agreement was signed, in 2004 is when the assignments happened, the assignment from BECR to Horvat Investments, to John J. Horvat, to Ronald Bowens. So 1 year after his signature on the settlement agreement, where he's provided notice of all these provisions, he's assigned the bond. And now he comes forward and argues that he had no notice of this adverse claim to the bond under the UCC. The trial court rejected that, found that he wasn't a protected purchaser, and because he did have notice of the adverse claim. Regarding the what is a notice of an adverse claim or what is an adverse claim, like Mr. Thorburn mentioned, case law, there's not much case law. It's really the official comment and arguing the official comment. He argued one provision of the official comment, which provides that possibly simple breach of contract actions don't rise to notice of an adverse claim. But as you read farther down that same official comment, it refers to the fact that in circumstances where there's fraud or there's a right established by another law to rescind the transaction in which the bond was transferred, that then that is notice of an adverse claim. We have that exact same situation here. We have the fraudulent transfer that happened of the bond that the court found happened from all those individuals, including Ronald Bowens. So that includes, to the extent you don't agree that there was notice of an adverse claim, the official comment does provide in this situation, the fraudulent transfer provides the adverse claim to which Mr. Bowens had notice of.
Counsel, in your view, apart from the fraudulent transfer feature of this, is a contract, in your view, a simple contract claim if it provides for specific performance?
Is the contract one
that provides? In other words, I think you just said that Mr. Bowens wouldn't have an action here if it were merely a simple contract claim.
Mm-hmm.
Is this not a simple contract claim because of the specific performance aspect of the contract?
No, I get the sense from reading the official comments. What happens here is that it's more a level of notice. Looking at 48105, the official comment in there says, whether C had notice of an adverse claim depends on whether C had sufficient awareness that A was acting in violation of B's property rights. So to me, it goes along the lines of what level of awareness did you have? So simple breach of contract action, I don't know what the facts are there, but here we have awareness all along the way because of Mr. Bowen's signature on the settlement agreement, signature on the inclusion agreement, and working with the fellow, you know, John J. Horvat and the plaintiffs. So I think it goes to level of notice. So in terms of specific performance, it wouldn't be along the lines of that. It'd be more that Meadow Homes had the right to the bond pursuant to the contract, pursuant to the settlement agreement.
Thank you.
Right.
Doesn't it also, though, go to the definition of adverse claim in 8102? Adverse claim now, in a rule in the New York case, it says you have to have not just a breach of contract action, but some kind of property interest in the security or bond.
Right, and here we do have the property interest because Meadow had its interest in the property of the bond. And also, the official comment, as I was saying before, spoke further about what level of awareness is required to have that notice of the adverse claim, but also for just definition of an adverse claim, what has to happen. And to me, the facts show that there was a level of knowledge on the part of Bowens such that he knew what the provisions were. 1 year before he was transferred that bond, he was a signature on the settlement agreement. He knew what was going on. This bond was to be transferred to Meadow if the underlying contract was defaulted on by BECR.
And tell me about the bond itself. It's the type of bond, the rights it gives is important for the developer, ultimate developer, to have, isn't it? Isn't that why the agreement went that way? Whoever develops the land needs this bond. Was that the thinking, or?
Yes, that is part of the thinking behind that. And it has a monetary value that all the parties are interested in. And so that's one of the reasons why it's such a big issue in this litigation. But there's also along the lines of the fraudulent transfer. Pardon me, let me go back. There was an argument raised in the reply brief for the first time regarding the rule against perpetuities. Like I said, it was raised for the first time in the reply brief, but also Mr. Bowens fails to show that it actually had been raised in the trial court. And in the oral ruling, the trial court has decided against the rule against perpetuities argument. But on another point, the statute, which is CRS 1511-1105, provides that the rule against perpetuities does not apply to commercial transactions any longer. Plus, 1511-1107 provides that there is no common law rule against perpetuities. So to the extent that this argument that the process that Mr. Bowens knew of, not the date, but the process, somehow violates the rule against perpetuities, doesn't apply in this case. And as for the fraudulent transfer argument, we kind of have some back and forth going on here with the UCC and the Fraudulent Transfer Act. As I said, the court found all along the line that the fraudulent transfer had happened. And what occurred here was the court on the remedies provision said that it had been decided really pursuant to the UCC that that Meadow Homes was entitled to the bond, not Bowens. And so therefore it took it out of the provisions of 38.8.109, which allowed for certain remedies to happen. But on top of that, the Fraudulent Transfer Act has a statute 38.8.111, which says that if there are independent remedies out there, that you do not have to follow the remedies provided for in the Fraudulent Transfer Act. So that's where the trial court brought it back around and said that due to its notice provisions that Meadow was entitled to the bond and that Mr. Bowens was not entitled to receive anything except the $50,000 that he would have received as a simple assignee under the bond.
Can I accept and factor in terms of value? Do you agree with the representation was worth about $50,000 in 04, $50,000 in 06, and all of a sudden now it's worth, what, over half a million? And is that correct factually? And if so, what causes that up big increase in value?
As I understand it, I mean, the land itself has quite a bit of value now. And before, when it wasn't developed, it didn't have as much value. So therefore, the water rights didn't have as much value. Now they do have quite a bit of value because the land is being developed.
Being developed by Meadow Homes?
It's being developed by the different owners of the phases, yes. One of which is Meadow Homes, correct. And related to your questions about the findings of fact, that is one major issue here is the Court of Appeals right now is not in a position to make decisions regarding findings of fact due to the limited review provided to you by the limited record provided, which was simply the oral ruling transcript, not the transcript of the 5 days of trial, not the motions along the way. It's an 06 case. It was decided in 08. There's 2 full years of motions. Lots of things happened in this case that I won't go into because it's not a finding of fact situation. One of the findings of fact that Mr. Bowens asked you to make is that he's a good faith purchaser. That is the burden of Mr. Bowens to have made in the trial court, and the trial court did not make a finding that he was a good faith purchaser under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. Therefore, he's not entitled to not have the bond voided. So in as much as he's arguing that, I don't believe that this Court of Appeals is in a position to make that finding of fact. Overall, I'm sorry, one more point is regarding the attorney fees at issue in this case. This was a settlement agreement, and the settlement agreement provided that should any action be commenced to enforce this agreement or relating to this agreement, the prevailing party shall get appellate fees. We argue that in our response brief, and the reply brief was argued that because attorney fees were not provided in the trial court, that somehow they're not provided for in the appellate court. I would argue that this entire appeal really relates to the settlement agreement because the settlement agreement provided the notice provision that Mr. Bowens now complains of. So I would argue that Meadow Homes is entitled to attorney fees because this appeal does relate to the settlement agreement.
Didn't you make the question is, did the litigation relate? And in the trial court found that the litigation did not relate.
Correct.
You didn't cross-appeal that. If we found that it related, we'd be doing something contrary to the law established by the trial court and not appealed by you, wouldn't we?
What the trial court found was that there was not appellate or attorney fees that would be allowed because there was some kind of breach of the settlement agreement. And that goes to the language in the attorney fees provision to enforce this agreement. What I'm arguing is now we're at the next stage where this is along the lines of relating to this settlement agreement. So it's much more broad, and I think you could make another finding that we are entitled, or that Meadow Homes is entitled to attorney fees due to the fact that it is relating to the settlement agreement. I don't think that runs contrary to what the trial court has said, because the trial court stated that it was not going to award attorney fees because it didn't find that Mr. Bowens had breached the settlement agreement. So in the end, I would argue that that Meadow Homes is entitled to the bond as it was provided for in the trial court, and that you deny the appeal brought by Mr. Bowens. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you.
One question brought up by opposing counsel. What would have happened in this case if there had been no amendments entered into in December? That it just stopped. Under their argument, they'd have the right to the bond forever because there was no notice of default issued. And potentially, if there wasn't a default, the contract just ended. But their right would continue forever. I don't think that's what was meant in any of these agreements.
Let me ask you, what agreement set August 31, 04 as the closing date on phase four?
It was the last amendment to the underlying contract, which showed the closing of phase four to be August 31st, 2004.
And was your client signatory to that?
No.
So what's the basis, what record evidence is there that he ever had notice of that date?
Where the trial court was going is that the underlying contract was referenced in the settlement agreement. And so the court was saying that Bowens had notice of the underlying contract via the settlement agreement. There. And so if he had notice of the underlying contract, well, obviously he had notice of the closing dates.
Your argument, as I understand, is that I thought your argument was that he had notice of the August 31 closing, and he could have assumed that it closed and that Box Elder closed on that date and therefore had the full untethered ownership of the bond. Isn't that your argument?
Yes,
And
certainly.
I guess my argument is where in the record is there that your client had notice of the August 31, 04 closing date?
It, again, is in the underlying contract, which is incorporated by reference into the settlement agreement. And the court found, and this was one of the findings of the court, and maybe you disagree, but the court found that Bowens had notice of the underlying contract and the settlement dates and the terms therein by virtue of the settlement agreement. And so if he had notice of the underlying contract, I think he had notice of the closing dates also.
And wouldn't it be incumbent on him to say inquiry? He had inquiry notice then. Box Elder, did you close then? What are your rights in the bond? What's the rights of Meadow Homes? Doesn't he have some kind of notice that it is at least some claim of Meadow Homes to the bond, depending on what happened on August 31?
I believe under the current UCC, the answer is no. But even if he did, as the court found, he understood that everything had terminated.
Where did the court find that he understood everything had terminated?
I believe that it's towards the end of the written decision. But he does say that that despite the fact that Mr. Bowens understood that it closed on August 31st, 2004, he was incorrect. And then he goes on to talk about the subsequent amendments. It is in the written decision. He does make a finding of fact that Mr. Bowens understood that it was supposed to happen at August 31st, 2004, and it didn't. I'd like to just go in briefly into the issue of fraudulent transfers. I notice I only have about a minute and a half left here. Should we make the Fraudulent Transfer Act a method of specific performance? as a matter of public policy, don't believe that it should be a tool-specific performance. Contract law, common law, is an issue of damages. And the other thing, too, is if it's specific performance, we have the case that someone could bring back into the estate not only what the value of the original claim was, but the value of the appreciation of whatever this asset was under specific performance. In other words, they could get a windfall. The Meadow has already addressed that. They're not the only ones that are benefiting from this bond.
Mr. Thorburn, I have to interrupt you there. Why okay. would that be a windfall to Meadow Homes? Meadow Homes had a contract right to the bond. So it had a right to whatever value that is, if it's $50,000 or $500,000. It seems to me your client who didn't have a right to the bond wants the windfall. He wants to only pay $50,000 for something worth $500,000 that rightfully belongs to Meadow Homes.
Well, it wasn't worth $500,000 at that time, and Meadow had acknowledged in their briefing that the value, at least as of 2006, was only $50,000. It was speculative on anybody's part that the value of this bond would go up. Mr. Bowens speculated on that, and he was the one that laid out the money. Meadow could have done it too, but they chose not to. Should they be allowed, as a matter of public policy, to sit back and wait to see if, in fact, the security goes up in value, and then once it goes up in value, say, I want it?
Mr. Thorburn, it seems to me that under the record we have, which is sparse, mm-hmm. that once Meadow Homes was told that there hadn't been a closing, this other entity was not going to close, you may buy the property, that it acted promptly and did that. So it didn't sit back and wait for, I mean, they couldn't purchase the property until they were given notice that the other entity had not closed. That happened in 2006. So they act promptly. They say, we will buy. We also want the bond. How is that sitting on their hands?
Meadow Homes was an additional purchaser under the underlying contract, under some of the amendments. Meadow Homes understood that this was supposed to close under August 31st, 2004. August 31st, 2004 came and went, and nothing happened. Now, Meadow Homes being a signatory and an additional purchaser under that agreement should have had some duties. If you're putting Mr. Bowens a duty of inquiry, certainly a signatory to the agreement has a duty of inquiry. And based upon that, and seeing that, well, maybe there were some negotiations going on, whatever was going on, they sat back and did nothing. They could have purchased the bond in 2004 when this went past the closing and didn't happen.
What record evidence is there of that? Point me to that in the record, that they could have done that. That they could have bought it after it didn't close in August 31. There were all these extensions after that.
After they went out of contract. The contract had expired in August 31st, 2004. It wasn't until 3 months later that there was an amendment drafted. And so based upon that and based upon the court's rulings there, they should have taken some action at that point, it would seem to me, there, rather than sitting back and saying, well, no, we're not going to do anything about this. And if there had been no amendments at that juncture, there would have been, you know, would they have been able just to wait forever to purchase the bond? If there had been no amendments, you know, potentially. But then again, we have the perpetuities issue.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
That concludes the argument in this case.